most of the breaches that we're seeing, it's not because someone gets into Amazon and, like, you know, is wandering around the cloud. It's because, you know, some dope at a hospital left their computer on and someone came and walked towards it and did it. I mean, almost all the breaches are basically some person doing something dumb.
If you feel reluctant about putting your credit card on the internet, boy, you should feel really reluctant about putting your genomic data on the internet.
This is Tectonic, the podcast focused on the people and passion at the intersection of technology and health. I'm David Shaywitz.
And I'm Lisa Soonan. And we're excited to be here today to have our 25th episode of Tectonic.
Woohoo!
We had a great 2015 with this podcast. It was a lot of fun, and we spent a lot of time with some amazing thought leaders and entrepreneurs and investors and clinicians and folks who have made a real difference in the digital health field in particular. And while we are about to take a bit of a hiatus, while we focus on a couple other things and continue to look for a sponsor for the show in 2016.
So if you're interested, get in touch with us. We have a great idea of number of great guests who are willing to do the show for this upcoming year, and we just need the sponsorship to be able to keep going.
But we also couldn't help ourselves but take notice of some of the changing tides and changing market sentiments out there in the world of healthcare, and wanted to riff with each other a little bit about that and let you bear witness to that excitement.
So first of all, Lisa, hello!
David's been a little bit obsessed with that whole Seinfeld voice thing.
Hello!
Which probably would have been a more euphoric and appropriate sound to make in the time of the unicorn and not the unicorpse.
So what's going on with all of this, Lee? What a great transition. So are unicorns dead or are they sleeping?
Oh, I think, yeah, are they just resting? Is that your point? You know, I think they're probably no longer that exciting to people, or at least not the goal. I think the whole idea that you've got to build companies that are going to be billion-dollar, you know, whatever's in valuation has beginning to give way to the idea that you might build companies that actually have real value.
I mean, it's interesting. There was a kind of a our friend Chamath, when he sort of went on this tweet storm, but he was pointing out that a lot of the companies that are even are responsible for some of this, you know, maybe some of these expectations, when they went public, they actually had a lot of revenue, whether Google or Facebook, whereas a lot of the companies now, it's all about sort of, you know, the rate of growth, but there's almost no revenue to speak of.
Well, it's really interesting. You know, I watched a pitch for an entrepreneur recently who was reporting about, you know, how he was measuring growth. And it was still focused on users, you know, and it had no bearing on revenue or God help us all, profit. And I think that we've seen, you know, tremendous punishment in the marketplace for companies that went public on the promises as if they were the internet companies of 2000, you know, timeframe. And, you know, the aftermarket performance of them, you know, surprise, surprise, is not that great. And they're all, you know, floundering. You know, just
are there some that come to mind?
Well, I think, you know, I hate to pick on any individual company that, you know, may or may not start with C or any other, but I if you look back at all of the digital health, quote unquote, IPOs of the past, I think 2 or 3 years, I don't think there's a single one of them that's materially above its IPO price, except for maybe Veeva.
Right. Others that people talk about are that are not above their IPO price, to put it gently, are companies like Fitbit and Castlight.
Yeah, there's many, and you know, and granted, we're having a general market turndown, and there were no IPOs in January.
Zero.
At all.
Yeah.
And in February,
brutal.
You know, we've had some, but the digital health world in particular seems to be fairly well out of the picture. And while biotech is still, you know, chugging away in its own form, I think there's a growing recognition that the way the market values things, based on old-fashioned metrics like, you know, growth rates in revenue and growth rates in profit and, you know, the sustainability of customer bases and the like, is may actually have some value.
Now, this isn't a point that you've just come to now. I mean, as I recall, for the last 10 years, you've been preaching this to your students at Berkeley, Haas, and other places, the idea of you actually have to look at a real business model and have been concerned that people haven't been doing this. Is that right?
Well, that's definitely true. And I always find it amusing that you can say the same thing for 10 years and at one point look like an idiot and later look like you're super smart. And I'll probably just look like an idiot again in 10 more years. But I guess for me, you know, the way I was taught a business needs to have certain fundamentals, and valuation isn't one of them, you know, or at least independent valuation in the private market isn't one of them. You know, the public market will reward you with good valuation for success, and success is defined by basic business fundamentals. And I think that, you know, as I spend my time traversing around with young companies, that message is still delayed, you know?
It's interesting because there was a headline I know in Fast Company that caught both of our eyes. It was, to me, it was amazing that this was news or a headline, but from what you're saying, it was actually important that some of the younger entrepreneurs see this. And the headline said, call it the Theranos effect. Health tech startups now face a burden of proof.
Yeah, a burden
of proof. As if it's a novel concept.
Well, I think it's so interesting. I mean, we've had many of our you know, guests this year, and especially like Brennan Spiegel, for instance, talk about the importance of proving out your value proposition to your client. And I think, you know, somewhere along the line, somebody woke up in, you know, in the last, you know, 18 months and said, oh, duh, we might have to study some of these things and put clinical studies together, economic studies together, and demonstrate efficacy. And I think that's become particularly poignant as so much of the venture money has moved from venture funds to corporate venture, and are particularly the provider and payer venture funds, where, which is making up, you know, the corporate venture funds are now making up more than 30% of healthcare funding. And they actually have a method of looking at these things and determining in real life in their operations if that's worth
it. So it's interesting. So maybe at one point some of these sort of corporate VCs were viewed as sort of the dumb money. And now your view is that actually it may be in the context of digital health a little bit savvier than some of the venture funds. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Well, I think it's certainly true when you're thinking about the venture funds that don't have a lot of healthcare experience. Maybe the ones that have a lot of healthcare experienced people in them or were already that savvy. But God, you know, no matter who it is, there was so much, many people got caught up in the, you know, in the excitement.
And, you know, there have been a lot of studies. You and I were talking a little bit earlier that, you know, there seems to just almost every week, and I know Michael Joyner at Mayo has been making this point a lot on Twitter, how there have been an increasing number of rigorous or more formalized studies that have been trying to look at the benefits of various digital health interventions, and many of them have struggled to demonstrate a real benefit.
Yeah, we've got a real Wizard of Oz effect going on here. Don't look behind the curtain. You can't say, I don't think it's fair to say that digital health isn't making a difference. I don't think it's fair to say that health IT isn't making a difference, because I think part of the problem is the time horizon in which you look at things, right? So we've been in this digital health, quote unquote, I still hate that term, cyclone for 5 years or so, right? And 5 years in healthcare is like 5 minutes in a lot of, in a lot of other industries. And really, I think we're going to have to look out 20 years from now and see what the impact of technology has been on how the healthcare system operates in order to measure efficacy.
So it's not so much that you think that digital health has failed. You feel like it's just still very, very early days, and you can't really evaluate if it's going to have proved itself in after 5 years.
Yeah, and I think what we've done, especially in Silicon Valley, is mistaken good ideas for good investments. You know, I think we've looked at a lot of these companies and said, these are amazing concepts. We can make things better, smarter, faster. And what we forgot to do is read the fine print that says it'll take 27 years for that to work, because the investment horizon for funds is, 5 to 10 years.
Right.
And at least the time to return capital. But the time for those impacts to really flow is long.
Right. Where do you see, are there opportunities that you see as nearer term? Are there some areas where you see that we're closer to realizing some of the benefits or anticipated benefits? Because one of the things we were talking about earlier is how fast things have gone from being this sort of this fever pitch. You know, people talk about being at the, this incredible time of, inflated expectations, to now this sort of, the trough of this despair. I mean, we actually talked about this on our podcast with Brennan. I think people are increasingly conscious of this. But what's it going to take to where, I don't think anyone's going to thinks that, the answer is not to invest at all. Are there particular areas that you think are going to see a return in a shorter time horizon?
You know, I think that Gartner hype cycle reference is a great one, I think, because – and if you haven't seen the Gartner hype cycle out there, go look it up on Google, because it talks about how new ideas, reach a crescendo of excitement. Peak of inflated expectations is called, and then they drop into this trough of disillusionment, and then they slowly, at a different slope, come back up. And
re-equilibrate.
Yeah. I don't know if we're at the top of the peak or at the bottom of the trough and coming back. I don't know exactly where we are in this yet. I think we're probably halfway down the downslope or partway down the downslope. And, the good news is in a market that's declining from a stock market valuation standpoint, you can more effectively buy low and sell high.
Absolutely.
Right. So, that's the trick. But still catching these things in healthcare, being the earliest of adopters or earliest first guy out there with an idea is not always the best thing because timing takes so long.
Yeah, but on the other hand, does some of that not reinforce some of the more conservative healthcare institutions that say, well, we're not going to jump into digital health. We're not going to jump into any of this. Let's let it all settle itself out. Let's let the technologies evolve. And then after it's evolved, we'll figure it out.
I think
if you're advising a health, if you're advising a health system or a hospital, mm-hmm. and someone says, well, look, we love the idea of the technology. It's going to take a while. Why should we jump in now? What would you be able to persuade them that there are some areas within digital health where they should jump in, where it really might make a difference?
I definitely think they have to start now because it takes a long time to pay off, right? And they have to start retraining and rethinking their teams and who can effectively implement technology and different service models in order to survive because, however long it takes for businesses to evolve, regulations evolving really quickly, and CMS has said they're going to have some, 50% of their payments and value-based, shared risk, whatever, define it however you want, models over the next couple of years. Whether or not that's really what happens, it's going to happen over the next some number of years, and they got to start thinking about how to transform their business. And I also think that, particularly in the provider and the payer worlds, they have to step up and play, even if they don't fundamentally alter, because they have to be perceived as in the mix.
So it's sort of almost more like assent without belief is okay, and that they can sort of get religion later on?
Or maybe they can just do, religion light and later get baptized.
We're going to get all our analogies messed up. But so one of the areas that I'm, maybe to specifically, sort of press you on is the area of patient engagement. There's a lot of, I feel like, and certainly in the area of, that I'm sort of particularly interested in of precision medicine, been following a lot of this, not following, I would say deeply living. That's absolutely right. The evolution from the president's precision medicine announcement last year to the recent follow-up, where there really seems to be a huge amount of emphasis on the patient as participant and at the center of the ecosystem, the idea of how important it is for patients to own their own data. There have been a lot of, speaking of regulation, there have been some very positive and proactive moves by the government to specifically ensure that HIPAA isn't incorrectly applied and that people recognize that if you want your data, you in theory, we'll talk about this in a minute, have the right to it. So it seems that there's a huge, very high level commitment.
Huge or huge?
Huge! It's huge! sort of huge opportunity for patient engagement. Is that something that you think is one of the big opportunities, or is that something that's become almost an empty buzzword that everyone talks about but is... at one point, David Chase said, patient engagement is the, super drug or whatever
blockbuster drug,
blockbuster drug. Are you seeing that play out, or is there something about patient engagement that we're not missing? And sorry, to even make it more complicated, at this MIT conference I was just at this past week, kind of a leading healthcare executive. And I've heard this a lot, was just expressing his frustration that he was saying, he's at a drug company, he makes drugs, but he's saying for so many conditions, people would just like eat better and exercise more, they'd be healthier. And that he thinks that a big thing is not drugs, not anything else, but just getting people to take some ownership of their own health. Is that something that we can really impact?
I don't know that you can fix adults who have baked in habits that are bad and who are fighting, even if when they have good intentions, are fighting every day the checkout counter at the grocery store where all the junk is sitting, right? the advertising, the billions of dollars that goes into advertising Coca-Cola and everything else, you know, the Super Bowl is all about bad health, you know? I mean, if the Super Bowl is about treating erectile dysfunction and eating crappy food. And I think that, or in this year, maybe it's about, you know, opiate-induced, bowel problems, which is particularly scary. But, I think the patient engagement thing, well, first of all, I think the words have become meaningless. I do. I think they've been overused to the point of nobody hears them anymore. And it sounds like, you know, that wah, wah, wah in the Snoopy, you know, Charlie Brown cartoons. And I think most patients really don't want to be engaged on a fundamental basis day to day in their health. Most people, forget patients, you know, they just people. Just, that's not the thing they want to think about all day long. And if
but
you
if
don't,
they do have a health issue, they do want to act.
Except if they've got a crisis, right? And by the time you got a crisis, you're already too late to do what you already just said. You know, for the most part, I mean, you can take active, you can actively affect the trajectory of your current crisis by doing better things for yourself, no doubt. But can you suddenly uneat all the bad food you've eaten and suddenly undo, you know, the couch sitting you've done? No, you can't. And I think for me, the most fundamental change we could make to really get patients to be more accountable is teach children from birth, you know, and in school about nutrition and exercise in a way that makes it meaningful now. Because the biggest problem, I think, is the delayed gratification of acting, right? If I don't act today, will it matter if I act tomorrow? Can I put it off a day and a day and a day and a day? Because when do I see the payoff of eating broccoli instead of a Twinkie, you know?
One of the other things that you also have I think, recently highlighted, and that I think I saw highlighted also by, again, one of our other guests, Sean Wilbanks, even recently on Twitter, was he was saying, well, it's great that there's these high-level initiatives that say, oh, patient empowerment, patient data, patient ownership. But the real thing isn't at the very high level. It's great that Obama, it really is great that Obama and Biden have really emphasized. I think it's unquestionably a terrific, terrific thing. But he was pointing out that the issue is really what happens at sort of the levels beneath that. The person who runs the study section, or the people who are actually making some of the decisions, how much are they going to sort of accept some of this patient-centeredness? And you had a recent experience that I thought that is probably so representative of what so many, as far as I was going to listen to this and just like wince. But and someone else who was lined up to be a guest this year. So again, if you want to sponsor us, you get to hear more of Farzad. But why don't you talk about your experience that you've recently had that you've blogged about?
Yeah, you know, for those of you who read my Venture Valkyrie blog.
And who doesn't?
Yeah, right. I had a heart procedure in January. And one of the things prior to that is I asked a doctor friend of mine for a second opinion. And he said, go get me your data. And I called up the hospital where I had most recently been treated and said, I'd like my data, you know, emailed to me or something or downloaded onto some electronic form that I can have. And they said, we don't do that, you know, and if you want your data, you can come between, you know, 9 and 3 and we'll hand you a paper file and you'll be happy with that. And I said, well, you know, you by law have to provide it to me in electronic form if I request it that way. And they said, we just simply don't do that and won't do that.
Sue us. Yeah.
And sue us basically is the implication of that. Right.
And this is like San Francisco, you know, it's sort of like San Francisco, middle of all this technology stuff.
Exactly.
In theory, and then the reality and on the ground is, you know, stuff
it. Yeah. And I couldn't get the data. I could have, but I didn't. Frankly, it stopped me. It stopped me from getting it, you know, and I consider myself a person who knows better. And yet it still stopped me because I didn't go between 9 and 3 to pick it up. I didn't end up getting the second opinion from that particular guy. And I think in my particular situation, that was okay. I think if I had had cancer, I might have done something more proactive.
God forbid, yeah.
Yeah, God forbid. But I don't think, you know, patients are willing or ready to make the kind of active commitment that people hope for, with rare exception. And there are exceptions, but it's not the norm. It's not the norm.
Well, it's interesting because I reviewed a book. You probably saw it last year for the Wall Street Journal that was essentially basically about how to be a tiger patient. And a lot of it involved all the things that you should do proactively.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, when I think of people, probably almost everyone I know included, you know, the idea of being of organizing and doing all of that, I of getting everything so together in such a proactive way. you know, I don't know almost anyone who does that proactively. And then I do know people, like, once a health crisis, you know, heaven forbid, strikes, people really do start to get it together. Mm-hmm. But the question is, can one do it sort of ahead of time? What if you wanted to be optimistic, you could say that some of the emphasis on patient-centeredness and on the unquestioned right of patients to get the data, together with some of these sort of interoperability platforms, like, I'm very excited about, like, the FHIR open interface that really seems to be, again, a major theme of the emerging from the most recent sort of precision medicine announcements, you'd like to think that even if patients aren't going to be able to or aren't going to be that motivated to do it on their own, maybe they might at least be able to empower an agent, empower someone who can almost make that their business,
right,
to say, okay, there are many things that you know you should do that you might not do. But if you're able to sort of authorize someone to, on my behalf, get all my health shit together, please.
Yeah.
They might actually do that. And if that could become a viable business because they can at least access your data in a way less that doesn't quite require the cost of this. You know, the book that I review is written by this guy who runs some, like, sort of super high-end concierge practice in L.A., I think. And that's basically what they would do. They would, on behalf of the patients, hassle the shit out of hospitals until they got all their old records, and then they would organize it in some binders. So the idea is that if you could essentially do that in a expedited way using technology instead of, you know, this team of people who are just annoying, you know, who are just on it, wouldn't that be really great for more people? You could sort of scale his approach and do it and benefit more people.
Yeah, I think in theory that makes a lot of sense. The thing that I think will continue to hamper that for a while is the fears about security. Hmm. I mean, I every day we're seeing another article. This one's, you know, data's been hacked. That one's data's been hacked. I mean, I'm sure.
Or ransomed, right?
Yeah, ransomed. God, we saw, a hospital pay ransom to get their data
Hollywood
back
hospital,
the last couple
right,
weeks. Hollywood Hospital, right? And, you know, that's kind of stunning. And what was more stunning about that wasn't that it happened, but that I heard it was like the seventh instance of that happening when I read the article.
Huh.
Wasn't the first. And, you know, I think the reluctance that people feel about, you know, if you feel reluctant about putting your credit card on the internet, boy, you should feel really reluctant about putting your genomic data on the internet or anywhere where it could be accessed by others. And yet that is the whole focus of a lot of this precision medicine activity, which it should be. That is the whole focus of predictive analytics, you know, is pulling this data together, normalizing it to the patient and making it available to look at and analyze. But if all of that's out there and easily breachable, that's scary.
Yeah, I think that the extent to which it's breachable, since it's part of our business, we're fairly sensitive to that, is all data isn't sort of equally breachable. And
sure.
I think that there's a lot of ways one can organize. And I think hopefully there'll be sort of complete self-interest here. But when it's in a, like ours at DNA Nexus, a secure and compliant cloud platform, it isn't easily breachable. And that's sort of the whole point of it.
Right.
But I think that the general point you're making is, I think that there really is a balance between, on the one hand, these sort of efforts to say there's huge value in sharing one's info. And I guess what you can sort of say is, let's see, it'll be really interesting to see if there's more some catastrophic event that happens from someone's really personal data getting hacked.
Well, there is.
Hacked. But sort of if that sort of happens and people say, wait a minute, this sharing is just, it just scares people to share. Or if you start seeing what we're also seeing examples of, some emerging examples where, as a result of people coming together and sharing information that's for genetic or health data, people are able to get new insights and are able to understand what disease they might have, what treatments might be better. I think there's huge potential to improve the care people get for cancer, for rare diseases, for a variety of conditions by, in a suitable, again, I would say compliant cloud environment, but whatever the approach is, to bring data together and to be able to use it to inform health. I think it's really interesting to wonder, and we don't know the answer, are we going to see, in both of these things, I think I would argue, have been either overpromised or sort of overly feared. People have said, oh, you put all the data together in a vat, you're going to have great insight and transform health. I mean, frankly, I believe that. I believe that we're going to get to that. And I think we're starting to see evidence of that. Other people say, you put all the data in a vat, some of it's going to get out, and bad things are going to start happening. And we're starting to see some evidence of that.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's an article actually in the recent weeks about a woman who couldn't get life insurance because she'd had her DNA test done by, I don't know, 23andMe or somebody. And the life insurance company got a hold of the data and said, you have a negative BRCA2, you know, gene situation, so well, we're not going to give you insurance.
So to be clear about that, because we both read and we're talking about the same thing, it wasn't somebody whose DNA, whose data got hacked.
No.
It wasn't someone who found it on the internet. So this is distinct from security and distinct from a breach. This is an example of someone who, in the context of applying for life insurance, which unfortunately is not covered by GINA, health insurance is covered by GINA, life insurance is not, because and there are other applications that are not unfortunately covered by GINA.
What is GINA for the audience?
GINA is the law that makes it illegal to discriminate for the application of health insurance on the basis of genetic data.
Right. You know, I agree. Yes, clearly that wasn't a situation.
And it was someone who would disclose that the person felt obliged to disclose because they had the test done.
Yeah. But even if they hadn't disclosed it and it's just out there in the databases you can get on people, which are numerous and growing.
Well, but I don't – so again, we could maybe have a discussion of this. I don't think that someone would have been able – that an insurance company would have been able to get this person's genetic data. Certainly, their identified genetic data from coming like 23andMe would categorically not happen. But I think your general worry is as more and more data gets out, it's likely that someone has access to something you might not want them to have.
Yeah. And I think – that's an interesting issue. I think the regulations and the laws haven't caught up with the data and the technology yet in some of these instances. And some of it's the security hasn't caught up with the data yet, because I don't think anybody would have expected that their data in hospitals or health systems would be hackable in the easy manner it appears to be, which is different than maybe what DNA Nexus and other companies have done to secure it. But nevertheless, these are the people who have your data. So it's an interesting challenge, and I think I agree with you very, very much that as we look back, 20 years from now, we're going to say that all this, you know, yada yada about precision medicine has yielded something of value, has yielded actual personalization of medicine, which is, I think, more of what we're really mean.
And I think we're going to get to that. We're going to get to the demonstration of value. But in order to get that, it's going to require the sharing, the collaboration in a secure, of course, in a secure and compliant way. But I think that it's only through the sharing. I mean, I think one of the things that we're really seeing is there's a huge, I mean, I guess, depending on which side of the part of the glass you're looking at, I see there's a huge amount of, I think Biden is lamenting the huge amount of progress in oncology and other diseases that's not happening because data aren't being shared. They're being siloed. They're being kept in one location. And places, you know, if someone gets, you know, has a diagnosis, receives a treatment, and the treatment isn't super effective, that's incredibly unfortunate. But what really makes it tragic is then when someone else who's so similar has that same experience and didn't have the benefit of learning from the experiences of the first person, of having the knowledge gained of how much knowledge individual doctors, individual hospitals, and then our system as a whole is collectively leaving on the table, that if we were able to share it, and again, I would say there are technologies that enable to do this. I mean, most of the hacks, most of the, you know, breaches that we're seeing, it's not because someone gets into Amazon and, like, you know, is wandering around the cloud. It's because, you know, some dope at a hospital left their computer on and someone came and walked towards it and did it. I mean, almost all the breaches are like, you know, that you hear about are basically some person doing something dumb. But it's still, you have to deal with it.
Yeah. And well, that's true. And but although they're also, you know, backdoor entry points into some of these, you know, databases to a certain extent too, which is, I'm sure, why Apple's concerned, which makes perfect sense to me in a lot of ways. You know, it's an interesting challenge, but I do think that if you think about, you know, if you're going to the silver lining of the cloud,
yes.
You know, the importance of this data, and particularly as we move from predictive analytics to prescriptive analytics, to where you're using it to actually make recommendations, not just lists of people who might have a problem someday. You know, there's nothing more valuable than that, right? Being able to predict when something's going to go wrong with somebody and actually prescribe, quote unquote, or recommend actions to forestall that. I can't imagine any more useful, you know, value of data than that. And it seems to be where a lot of the energy is going, which I think is important and essential to success.
Absolutely. I mean, we're so excited by the progress that we're already seeing in this area, that we're seeing in drug discovery, that we're seeing among hospital centers. I think that you're right that these are early days, and I think that as we start to see some of all the data collection and some of the data sharing and integration really start to make a clinical impact, you start to appreciate the benefits. Mm-hmm. The same way that if you use Uber and a car shows up, you're like, oh, this is great. Similarly, people are going to have a visceral sense of how helpful it is to collect and share and integrate the data, and it really is going to have such an impact that you can't help but, of course, you'd collect this, of course, you'd share it, and of course, you'd want it done in an appropriate way.
So early days, not end of days for digital health, huh?
Boom, that's it. So, and think how nice it would be to have a whole year of discussion with experts on all of these topics.
I think it would be fabulously interesting.
So if you're a sponsor, listen.
You know, and please do check out the 24 shows we've produced already are out there on iTunes to be found, as are David and my blogs and writings under Venture Valkyrie and under David Shaywitz.
At Forbes.
And thank you so much for your attention and interest in the show. We've actually had tremendously positive feedback and are very excited about the volume of listeners that we've managed to amass. And we look forward to engaging with you again soon.
Absolutely. Can't wait. Ciao.